Catton Camp against Cendant Timeshare Resort Group. Mr. O'Reilly.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert O'Reilly. I represent Joseph Catton Camp. We're here today on a case that was summary judgment was granted to the defendant, Cendant Timeshare Resort Group Consumer Finance, Inc. The primary issue in the appeal is whether or not Cendant is a debt collector under the statute. It fits the statute, it fits the definition of a creditor, except for the fact that there's a provision in 1692A6, which provides that a person who uses a false name can be covered as a debt collector under the statute. The Seventh Circuit in White versus Goodman held that the provision forbids a creditor from suggesting the involvement of a third party in the collection of debts. And we submit that's exactly what they did. We attached the debt collection letter that we sued on as page one in our appendix, and I think that the letter is crystal clear that it's a debt collection letter that was sent by an entity that's called Resort Financial Services, using the acronym RFS. In smaller type, they put in there a division of CTRG Consumer Finance. The first sentence of the letter is, due to your failure to maintain your contractual obligation, Fairfield Communities, Inc. has referred your account to us for collection. Anyone who receives that letter would read that letter and think, well, I'm in the clutches of a debt collector. I'm not in the clutches of the creditor. I'm in the clutches of a debt collector. Similarly, at the bottom, they note that the validity of the debt will be verified in writing with the creditor. Well, of course, in this court, in the court below, Cendant has taken the position that they were the creditor, which is, of course, contrary to both of the statements that are included in the letter. And, of course, they also include the E11 disclaimer that this is an attempt to collect a debt and any information will be used for that purpose. I think that it fits squarely with...
The defendant acquired the account here before there was any default.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. That's what makes them a creditor. That's why the false name exception is relevant. If they acquired it upon default, then under a case like Fairbanks, they would be considered to be a debt collector because they acquired the debt after default. They acquired it beforehand. However, they're misrepresenting themselves. They're suggesting the involvement of a third party, this RFS.
But didn't the plaintiff here receive notice that the account was going to be serviced by...
I included what is considered notice. It's page 2 in the appendix. In page 2 of the appendix, it notes, there's not much of an explanation there. It says payments may be made or an additional down payment may be made to Fairfield Acceptance Corp. Now, of course, on the letter, there's no Fairfield Acceptance Corp. There's no communications that we have in the record between Fairfield Acceptance Corp. And the plaintiff, with probably the exception of the one letter that we sued upon. They didn't say that it's a division of Fairfield Acceptance Corp. If they had, we might come under a rule, for example, in the Lehigh case, where they said there's no way that you could confuse the Lehigh Country Club with the Lehigh Corporation. But we're not really talking about that situation. We're talking about a situation in which the letter comes in and says it's Fairfield Acceptance Corp. And then months and months later, they get a debt collection letter and says it's a division of CTRG Consumer Finance. Now, CTRG Consumer Finance is an abbreviation or an acronym for the Cendant, but there's no way that an unsophisticated consumer could tie Fairfield Acceptance Corp., which is referenced once in one page in a closing, with what you actually get on the letter. Not only that, you would have to disbelieve the statements that are actually included in the letter. You would ask an unsophisticated consumer to say, well, I know that the letter says that the Fairfield Communities referred your account to us for collection due to your failure to maintain your contractual obligation. But that's not true. It wasn't due to the failure to maintain the contractual obligation. It was done at servicing months before there was any default. So you're asking the naive, trusting, unsophisticated consumer to disbelieve that. Then, secondly, the naive, trusting, unsophisticated consumer would have to disbelieve the fact that the validity of the debt would be verified in writing with the creditor, when, in fact, it itself is the creditor. And, of course, the public policy behind these provisions animate this entire decision. The whole point of this is that the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act is premised on the fact that debt collectors will be less inclined to protect the goodwill in their names than a creditor would. There's nothing on that letter which uses the name Cendant, and I think that's for good reason, because Cendant doesn't want to sally itself with a letter like this one, in which it basically says, if you don't pay up immediately, you're going to face the legal consequences. They don't want to put Cendant's name on that. That's exactly the policy for bringing creditors under the FDCPA, to avoid those kinds of deceptive practices. And I don't think it's a question of confusion. I think it is a question of deception. I mean, I pointed out the false statements in this letter, and they're saying, well, notwithstanding those false efforts, we escape on a technicality. Well, I don't think they do. I'd like to just briefly address the motion that we made to amend the complaint to include two counts under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act. One was against Fairfield Resorts, who is the person who's actually making the federally related mortgage loan. There's no affirmative defense for that. Every person who makes the loan is required to provide the notice, even if they don't transfer the loan to anyone. The form says it, and there's no affirmative defense in that provision of the statute. Then secondly, with respect to the actual defendant, CTRG, who didn't provide a notice that they were required to under 2605B, there's a provision which excludes affiliates from having to do that, and they are an affiliate. But that exclusion is not absolute. If you change the name of the payee, the address, the account number, the amount, then you do have to provide a notice. Judge Clavert, without allowing us to conduct any discovery on this newly found claim, denied the amendment as futile. Well, of course, he didn't mention the exception to this affirmative defense. He simply granted the affirmative defense. And it's clear that complaints do not have to anticipate affirmative defenses. And we would certainly, if given the opportunity, we'll amend the complaint to allege that that exception to the affirmative defense applies and that the name changed or the address changed, the payee changed, et cetera. There's no way that the court's ruling on this matter should be affirmed with regard to the amendment, because the amendment is not futile. There are a set of facts that we can prove that would establish liability on these facts, and therefore the denial of the motion to amend the complaint was an abuse of discretion. I'd like to save my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, Mr. O'Reilly. Ms. Turk.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. O'Reilly. My name is Mary Turk, and I'm representing the defendant, Cendant Timeshare Resort Group Consumer Finance, Inc., which I'll refer to for ease as CTRG, with the permission of the court. Your Honors, this is a case about...
I assume the next federal law that you'll have to comply with is the law against non-pronounceable acronyms.
I believe you're right, Your Honor. This is a case about a creditor.
The NPA, the Non-Pronounceable Acronym Act of 2006, which, of course, would itself be a non-pronounceable acronym.
Your Honors, this is a case about a creditor collecting its own account using its own name. I think that a good analogy here is the square peg in the round hole. Plaintiffs are trying to make the false name exception apply.
Well, look, counsel, what worries me about this is precisely the language of the letter, which says that somebody else, Fairfield Resorts, has referred the letter to us for collection. And then it says, if you dispute this, we will verify the account, quote, with the creditor. What is a normal person, even for that matter, a normal lawyer, supposed to conclude other than the fact that this letter is coming from somebody who is not the creditor?
Well, I would submit to the court that we have to look at all the documents that are in the record. And included in the record is a letter that came a week before this letter, where, and that is at the record site 35.
I don't think the statute requires memory of our unsophisticated consumer, or even of our sophisticated one. Right, there are two documents. There's this cover letter, which utterly unambiguously says, we are not the creditor. This has been referred to us by the creditor, which means by somebody else. It names the somebody else with not its name and says, if you dispute it, we will verify it with the creditor. And then it attaches a document, the original loan, which shows the creditor to be somebody other than CTRG. What's left?
This court in Gutierrez set out three elements under the false name exception. The second of which is that the creditor must use a name other than its own in the debt collection. And the court in Gutierrez went through each of the elements, the first one being the creditor collect against own debt. That one is met here. But the second element is that a creditor uses a name other than its own. Plaintiffs cannot prove that element in this case because CTRG, it's undisputed, received this debt upon the inception, began servicing it, and then collected the RFS letter, clearly discloses that CTRG is an affiliate of RFS.
Why include all that information in the letter to begin with if it's the creditor collecting its own debt?
There is no evidence in the record regarding that, and I submit it's because plaintiffs didn't develop the record on this issue. It was plaintiffs' burden to come forth with evidence. Mr. Kattenkamp never testified that he was confused.
No evidence is needed in this case other than the letter. Right? The letter says we are collecting a debt from a third party. It screams that. And now you're saying, well, an unsophisticated consumer should have known that we were telling a lie in this letter and that really we were the creditor.
The unsophisticated consumer is deemed to have read all the documents. And in this case, Mr. Kattenkamp did read and sign, in fact, the contract addendum, which acknowledges that there's financial services who's involved, which is servicing the debt. So I think I don't think it's a clear case that the unsophisticated consumer would be confused when you look at all documents in the record. And in that case, the Sims case in this court and many others clearly state that plaintiffs have some burden to come up with evidence. And here we have nothing from Mr. Kattenkamp that he was confused. We don't know what Mr. Kattenkamp knew.
Completely irrelevant whether Kattenkamp was confused. This is an objective standard of the unsophisticated consumer, not the plaintiff, but the unsophisticated consumer.
In that case, Your Honor,
and before you were three unsophisticated consumers, so here we are.
In that case, Your Honors, I would go back to the Gutierrez case, which says first, before we determine whether the unsophisticated consumer would be confused, we figure out whether this is a case where a creditor...
Wouldn't it be simpler to say you owe me money or you owe us money?
Indeed, and more truthful.
Terse, gets to the point, lets everybody know, no problems, pay me.
And if you say that, then you don't have to include any of this.
Yeah.
Fair debt collection.
You just send a letter that says you're
business.
A deadbeat, pay up.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, they didn't do that. But they also they did provide information that's available in the contract addendum. And I'll point to the court the fact that this exception, the false name exception, is geared towards preventing creditors' involvement in flat rating. In White, this court said that the false name exception forbids a creditor in the collection of debts to use a name which suggests a third party unless a third party is participating. Then there's no deception. RFS was clearly participating in the collection of this debt. I will turn then to the court's decision on the motion to amend. This was a discretionary decision by Judge Clavert to deny the motion to amend to add the new claim. And as to the claim against Fairfield and CTRG under 24 CFR 3500.21, the affiliate exception clearly applies. The court was correct that plaintiffs pled themselves out of adding this new claim by admitting that CTRG received this loan at the inception of the loan, and therefore there was no change in the payee address and the other requirements to show the affiliate exception. So clearly the affiliate exception applies, and the court's decision should be affirmed. And with respect to the amendment to add Fair Debt Collection Practices claims against CTRG, CTRG is not a debt collector and therefore is not subject to the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Therefore, defendant requests that the decision by the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Turk. Anything further, Mr. O'Reilly?
Your Honor,
I simply want to bring to the court's attention, and it's in the brief, and so I don't want to belabor it, but I really think that the case that's really on all fours with this one is the case of McGuire versus Citicorp Retail Services. In that case, they didn't use Resort Financial Services. They used the name Debtors Assistance. And they didn't say a division of CTRG. They said a unit of CRS. And in that case, they said, yes, on the face of this, this would come under there. There was a question to what extent was the name CRS disclosed as meaning Citicorp Retail Services. And the case was remanded back to the court on that issue. However, in this case, the facts are clear and undisputed, and we provided those facts. There was no communication of the name change. There was no communication of this acronym. There's no evidence in the record that they used this acronym ever with any consumers, let alone the particular plaintiff in this case. And I really think that case, which was cited approvingly in White versus Goodman by the Seventh Circuit, is really one that could control this outcome of the case and really make this an easy case. And with respect, with respect to the motion to dismiss, I can simply say that no one has yet to address from Judge Clavert or from Ascendant why the affirmative defense with regard to affiliates would have any application to Fairfield Resorts or to any initial lender. That's a burden that's placed on all of them. And then secondly, I think that the record is in fact open on the issue of whether or not this particular element was transferred. Certainly we know by the time that the RFS letter was sent, they're saying, send us the payments. Don't send Fairfield Resorts. Send us the payments at a different address. At what point did it change? I'm not sure. We haven't had the opportunity to conduct discovery on that issue. In this case, discovery was only open for a few months, and we voluntarily limited to the issue of whether they were a debt collector. We didn't have the opportunity to explore this claim. We did file a motion we did file discovery, and Sendit filed a motion to stay discovery pending a ruling, so we did not get any discovery on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.